have a local, we have three local speakers. Our format here is that we have 2 7- to 10-minute speakers followed by a main 30-minute speaker. And it's a great pleasure of mine tonight to introduce our first 7 to 10-minute speaker, who's Todd.
I am an alcoholic. My name is Todd, and I've been sober since March 21st of 2005. And it's kind of like the book, the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous refers to being resurrected or, you know, pulled off the scrap heap. I literally lived in a scrapyard when I was on my way towards becoming sober. I started drinking at the age of 12, and I was a gulper. I was a fall down drunk. I was a put one foot on the floor when I went to bed kind of drinker. I always have the garbage can next to the bed kind of drinker. I was get so drunk that you need to leave the party and go lay in the woods kind of drinker. And that continued on for a long, long time. You know, I had some attributes. Well, all I really had as a teenager was a little skimpy mustache, but it did allow me to buy alcohol. And you know, it was not uncommon for me in the 11th grade to go down to Portland Distributing and load up kegs of whatever I wanted to head down to Dittler's for the parties. I was very good at orchestrating the parties, and I loved being the orchestrator. And I don't know, maybe hidden behind all the assessments mentally or whatever, maybe it was because I wanted to bring everybody, you know, the actor and as the book refers to, the orchestrator. I loved being that person. And, you know, military was about drinking. After the military was, it was always about drinking. And right into my mid-20s, it collapsed on me. And it became acceptable for me to live in my car. And then when I got, I was pulled over for the second time in a couple of days, no insurance. I was drunk the night before and had a DUI. You know, I got down to the tow yard, got my car out, and the cop that arrested me the night before was following me down the road, probably from a call from the tow yard. But anyway, you know, so I put on my backpack, got my fishing pole and blanket or whatever, and then I had a backpack. Okay, so then that became acceptable. And then, you know, like $12 hostel rooms downtown was acceptable. And then pitching my tent wherever, you know, that became acceptable. And then it was always drinking, and there's other parts to my story too. But, you know, I ended up laying underneath a semi-trailer in a wood lumberyard, scrapyard, or whatever, with a bunch of blankets I got from TPI Shelter downtown here, and had my clothes in a bucket. I guess maybe a divine intervention or what have you steered me towards recovery. And, you know, my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting was in Hood River, Oregon. And to be honest with you, my initial feeling about Alcoholics Anonymous was not very good. I was salivating at the jaws when I was leaving there because, you know, these people talking about alcohol, and my mind was out the window wondering, you know, what I was going to get up, really just about getting booze and heading to some creek to lay down in the creek bed or whatever and get hammered. But, you know, and then when they started holding hands and praying, that's kind of when I was like, because everybody's like this, and I'm like, you know, I'm looking around, and that scared me because I didn't know anything about what Alcoholics Anonymous was about. I had no idea. All I could do was associate prayer and God with churches, with religion, with all that. So, you know what? I didn't know. I was referred to a treatment program, got into a little bit of trouble with the law, and got to take a good look in the mirror. And after talking with family members, you know, looking at all the disappointment, missing my younger brother's birthdays, all the golden opportunities to, you know, like windsurf with my father or whatever, you know, just whatever. And I could not, I mean, it just cracked on the inside. That was it. I mean, and that's good. That was a good, you know, that was good. And that was after when I really woke up to that was after I had relapsed. And, you know, coming off that relapse, I knew a couple things right off the bat. I need to get out from where I'm at, and I need to go to AA. And so I started working, and then I needed to listen to my sponsor. So when my sponsor says, get your ass up and go to work, you know, don't say it's too cold outside to walk to the max and go to a meeting. You know, if you have problems walking by Pioneer Square where you know everybody or whatever, then avoid it. You know, and if you've got a problem, call somebody. And, you know, you always hear it, keep coming back, it works. And you know, the reason why I think it works, and it's my belief, and I love the Alcoholics Anonymous for that reason, is that it is a program. We have some wonderful guidelines, and we have the freedom to choose the people that we work with. So, fortunately, I fell into a great line of sponsorship, and you know, I had some wonderful things pointed out to me in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is, you know, you need to have, you know, you need to be willing. You need to be willing to get down to the meetings, get on the phone. You know, you need to be willing to do a lot of different things. Very important thing is honesty. And that perhaps could be maybe one of the most important things about achieving solid spirit, what I would hope, and confidence in myself, is just being honest. And that is that's something I'm working on. And I, you know, I'm doing okay. And open-mindedness. And whenever I'm not open-mindedness, or when I'm not open-minded, then it's pointed out to me just below that little section back there in the back of the book, contempt prior to investigation, that little thing back there, it's like, how do you know if you haven't tried it? So, end of argument for me. You know, I do not have a desire to use alcohol or drugs today. And the cornerstone of my program is a higher power. I do talk to God morning, noon, and night, and it's pretty simple sometimes. It's just like, your will, not mine, be done, you know. And then some great stuff through the step work, you know, that the outcome is, if you're really going to go down this road, Todd, then the outcome is going to be God's. So if you are feeling a certain way, or then you, that's okay for you to, you can accept it. It's got, look at the lesson of learning in that. And, you know, one thing that was really valuable for me to learn was also not to put expectations on other people's behaviors. Do not attach, you know, anything about it. If, you know, who knows what's going on in other people's lives? The program has taught me to be tolerant, you know, patient, you know, and try to know, you know, realize that a lot of people are having difficult times, and that they're growing too. And if I can be a benefit, then I need to. Then that'll be God's will then. That's my primary purpose today, is to make sure that that I'm going to be available to carry the message, you know, to stay sober and also be available to and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, for anybody here tonight who is doesn't understand how Alcoholics Anonymous works, or you're resting on your laurels and you've got some difficulties, get together with somebody who knows what they're doing by working the steps and work on those things and talk to some people, and don't be afraid to talk about what's going on in your head. There's some huge things that go on in these rooms. To go from a destroyed, broken, drunk spirit, you know, just crushed. I mean, I literally did not know how to be socialized, when to laugh, when to cry. You know, people would be having fun around me, and I just was like, this sucks. But I'm like, I'm just lost. I'm lost. Well, today I'm learning how to fit in. God has a power. His power is guiding me today. I go down the wrong road at times, self-will, and I'm doing stuff all the time. But back to the steps, on the phone with the sponsor, and some days it's just as simple as showing up to a meeting, socializing with the wonderful people in this program, and enjoying great meals and great days on the beach. I want to say thank you to my sponsor and those in this program who have helped me to understand how this program works and who have helped me stay clean and sober for 5 years now, a little over that. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd. Now please join me in extending a warm welcome to our second 7 to 10 minute speaker tonight, who is Barry.
Hi, I'm Barry. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, Barry. Wow, I'm so nervous. Ah, I feel like I'm going to have a heart attack. You didn't? Jeez. it's ridiculous. Anyways, I walked in the door tonight and I saw my friend Deborah and I was like, you know, I'm so nervous. I was like, but I have no reason to be because I'm home. Like, this is where my home is. You know, it's like I'm amongst my people. And I'm so grateful for that. And so thanks for being here. And my sobriety date is July 31st, 1998. And I want to say welcome to all the newcomers. And I'm really glad that you're here. And I hope you hear something that keeps you coming back. This is a great meeting. So anyways, when I was asked to speak, I was told to speak on steps 6 and 7. So I'm going to cover that just a little bit in the short amount of time that I have. And then just qualify a little bit to get started. When I first came to AA, I didn't like it at all. I mean, it could have been the reason because I was 15 years old. I had no intent on staying here. You know, I just went because the courts told me to. You know, my mom drove me, I went. And then I finally got sober in this period of time, which is almost 7 years, when I was 28. So I went to a lot of AA meetings that I didn't like. And I did not have the willingness, and I guess that I hadn't hit enough bottoms, because I hit many bottoms. I didn't hit one. I just drug along the bottom. I just kept on going deeper. So it took what it took, and I'm grateful that I'm alive. It's a miracle that I'm standing here today talking. And it's ironic that I got asked to speak on 6 and 7, because those two steps, I just... In this 7 years that I've been sober, about 6 months ago, I have really done them to the best of my ability, because they're kind of vague steps, and I didn't really get it. But when I first came in here, like, I saw the steps on the wall, and I was like, what I did is I just read them. And I was like, okay, I've done them. Check. Done. You know, I was like, I'm not going to put pen to paper and, like, do this. I was like, what's that, you know? I had no intent on staying here. I wanted you guys to fix me and just let me go. You know, this whole room freaked me out. All of you freaked me out. People freaked me out. Everything freaked me out, you know. I drank and drugged to escape. I didn't drink and drug to have fun, to fit in, to get liked, to be like, no. I drank and drugged for a complete oblivion, okay? So most of the time, that put me in my apartment alone. So I have a lot of sad stories. I don't have a lot of funny stories. Because I was sitting there killing myself, you know, and it started at 14, and I immediately started suffering consequences. I mean, I was you know, urinating in a cup for the courts at age 15, and I was using my neighbor's urine so that I didn't have to, you know, participate in getting sober. So it just went on and on like that, and I think what finally broke the straw, I mean, whatever that saying is, you know what I'm saying. Where I finally got to where I wanted to do this thing is I had to move from where I was living, and I did go to treatment for about, you know, like the 11th time. You don't have to do that. AA can work for you, but I just, this is my path, right? So I was ended up in treatment and, you know, three psych wards and things like this. And anyways, I finally committed to going to an all-women's facility. And there I couldn't, you know, pull any of my little tricks and secrets and manipulate. And let me just put it really bluntly. I was in a psych ward for 2 weeks on lockdown unit. They wouldn't even let me go out for cigarette breaks. And that's rightfully so, because I would have ran. But so then they flew me to Arizona, and I was like in heaven. I was like, wow, this is like a spa. It's gorgeous. The sunset is blue sky. I was like, okay. So that laid the ground, I think, though, for God to work in me and sort of gave me this divine intervention. And finally, I wanted this thing, and I finally was willing to go to any lengths. And what that looked like was listening to my counselors and, like, you know, doing the deal. And what that looked like is getting out and getting a sponsor immediately and doing these steps. And, I mean, what I did, the treatment center said to get a sponsor, so I just chose the first woman that I heard speak. And it turned out to be good. She was a great woman, and she had lots of vigor and, you know, enthusiasm for these steps, and that's what attracted me, because I knew I had to do this thing. Like, I knew I couldn't mess around. I couldn't just come and listen. I couldn't come to look for guys. I couldn't come to be social and dress cool and look good. Like, I had to do this thing. It was time. You know, I mean, I had been at this since age 14. I was killing myself. I was like, okay, I guess I can't just read them. Like, I need to do this thing. And so I finally got humble enough, and I started participating in this program. And the miracles started happening. And, here I go, emotions. That's one of the gifts, though, of sobriety, is that my heart has de-thawed. You know, I have lots of emotions. But basically, to cover 6 and 7, what I know right now, well, I know a lot of things about this program, but what's standing in my mind right now is, like, my feelings and thoughts change constantly, but my actions can't. What I do in the program cannot change, because once it does, it says it in the book, like, we rest on our laurels, and Todd mentioned that. And once I do that, I mean, my alcoholism sets in, and I suffer from the disease of alcoholism, and it's in my brain, and it's in my body. I'm allergic to it, and I also have the mental obsession. I mean, once anything mind mood-altering is in my body, all bets are off. You can just forget it. I won't show up, and I'll probably die. But and coming about 6 and 7, I don't know, it says step six, I'm just going to read it, we're entirely ready to have remove all these defects of character. That's really vague. Like, what? Okay, so I just say a prayer and they're done? Fine. You know, and that wasn't really it. That's not what this book says. This book talks about me having to participate, you know? And I'm going to read some of it really quickly. And about 6 months ago, I was hitting a bottom. I was breaking up with somebody, and I was super depressed, and I was just like, I was taking. I wasn't giving. I wasn't giving anything back to this program. And that's what keeps me sober today, is I have to give back. You know, I have to be of service. And that's an action. That's a pure action, people. That means I do it when I don't want to. It means I don't think about it. I just go. It means one foot in front of the other, and the results will follow. And that's what keeps me sober today. It sounds kind of like a robot, but hey, it works. So I can't sit there and, you know, think myself into right actions. I have to act myself into right thinking. Love that saying. Just had to say that. So I went to my sponsor about 6 months ago, and I was, you know, on this real, like, depression, contemplating getting back on medication and la, la, la. And they were like, have you done 6 and 7 thoroughly? And I'm like, sure, you know. And then so we got into it. Really, I don't think I had. And so I'm going to read a little bit of step six, and it says, "Since most of us are born with an abundance of natural desires, it isn't strange that we often let these far exceed their intended purpose. When they drive us blindly, or we willfully demand that they supply us with more satisfactions or pleasures than are possible or due us, that is the point at which we depart from the degree of perfection that God wishes for us here on earth. That is the measure of our character defects, or if you wish, of our sins. If we ask, God will certainly forgive our derelictions, but in no case does he render us white as snow and keep us that way without our cooperation. That is something we are supposed to be willing to work toward ourselves. He asks only that we try as best we know how to make progress in the building of character. So step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of characters. AA's way of stating that the best possible attitude one can take in order to make a beginning of this lifetime job." So basically what that says is, and there's also a seven-step prayer, but it's not in this book, it's in the big book. So my character defects look like, I mean, I pretty much have five major ones, and, you know, and I think they're kind of... universal amongst us. I mean, well, maybe not. I can only speak for myself. But the big one is low self-worth, low self-esteem. And I was like, well, how do I participate in that? Like, what do you mean? And so what I did is I said the seven-step prayer, which is on page 76 in the big book. I said that. And then it says right here, without our cooperation. So that means I need to participate, which means that I needed to act as if. And once I started acting as if, like, no self-esteem, like, I couldn't stand like this. You know, no, I mean, it's like, stand up straight, you know, say the prayer, you know what I mean? Say the prayer, and let God do the work, because he does, you know, he does it. No, I'm serious, it's that fundamental for me, you guys. I have to break it down, like body language and everything. So, and it really works, and I wish I could talk more, because I wanted to talk about seven, but my time is up, I think, isn't it? So, so that has been like a huge process for me, and the biggest place where I've used it is in my job. My job pretty much, you know, permeates my life, and I've been like sort of ashamed of it, and I've been hiding it as, I'm so humble, you know, and that's not it. It was really self-centered fear, you know, and low self-esteem, lots of low self-esteem. So now that I can pray and I can act as if, you know, I can feel the character defect coming and I can say, oh, there it is, and I can do the prayer and then I can act as if, and then guess what? It's gone, you know, and this way I can live a much happier person. I don't have to, you know, get deeper and deeper into my low self-worth and my low self-esteem and eventually want to drink, you know, because that's where it'll lead me, you know. And that's exactly what will happen, because my goal here is to stay sober, stay alive, and to have some peace. You know, and to feel good. I mean, I'm not here to feel like crap, you know, and that's what I felt like all the time. So it's like I'm willing to do this work, you know, because this is, it's the tools. So pick up the toolbox. But thank you for letting me share. Thanks.
Thank you, Barry. It's now... a great pleasure of mine to introduce our main 27 to 30 minute speaker tonight, Len Z.
I'm Lenny and I'm an alcoholic. You know, through God's grace, I've been around this thing since June 19th of 1972. And that seemed like a long time, but years fly by pretty fast. In the downside of being long-time sobriety, in 3 weeks I'll be 73 years old. And I really don't mind that, except 80 is awful close. I'm blessed, you know, to be standing here, you know, at my age, and a lot of guys my age are on a walker looking for the John, you know. And I'm still hustling around, you know, and that's the neat part. I've got a bad heart, and I've had for many years, and I got a little diabetes and all that stuff, but I just keep chugging along, and for that I'm grateful, you know, and it's neat to be sober. It's neat to be sober that long. I know a lot of people in this room, and you can't be around this program for 33 years and not know long people, and I've been active in service ever since I got around here. I started as a secretary in Then I was a GSR and a DCM, and I was a state chairman, and I was head of the finance committee, and alternate delegate, and done about everything. And I don't say that to be bragging, but it's kept me sober. And what I'm trying to say, if you want a little help with your sobriety, get involved with service work. I was thinking the other day, you know, Big John over here, many, many years ago, we did a mini-assembly in Wallowa. Is that how you pronounce that town? Yeah. Wallowa. That's close. And we had a mini-assembly to put up together one of the best mini-assemblies we've ever been. I still remember that. You know, and I've been going to those things for all these years, and I still go to all the conferences. I was just at Seaside, and I'm going to Grants Pass, and from Grants Pass, I'm going to Laughlin for the conference down there, and then in July, I've got the pleasure of going to Toronto for the World Conference, and it'll be my first sixth World Conference, and I do all that because it keeps me sober. You know, that's just part of my life, and it's pretty neat. If you haven't been involved, get involved. You know, many years ago, we started OB Speakers Meeting. It's me and Pete Flannery and Bob Masterson, and it's still going, and it's been going for a lot of years. It's been successful, and I'm still involved in that, you know, and I helped start Rose City Roundup, which will be Thanksgiving weekend, and we do Manuka Retreat, and I'm involved in that, and so I just say I'm doing all these things not to be bragging, just, hey, get involved. It keeps you sober. I know it has for me for 33 years. My wife says, give a good talk, and don't tell dirty jokes. I said, I always give a good talk, and I never tell dirty jokes. She said, you're wrong on both counts. So I says, you're not coming down with me? She says, no, I'm babysitting. We've got our great-grandson. It's a tough thing to say, but I got two great-grandsons. And, you know, just somebody will say, you know, for us drunks, people will ask me, yeah, but why did you have to drink? Why did you drink? I don't understand it. My sister tried to sober me up for many, many years, and right to this day, she says, yeah, but why do you have to take the first drink? I said, I could never explain that to you. But I can explain it to you guys, and I'll give you a graphic example. I used to wake up in the back of a car, and I didn't know where I was, how I got there, and I was just deathly ill, and I didn't think I'd survive. And you know, by magic, I reach on the floor, and there's a half a bottle left over from the night before. So I take a big pull of that bottle, and it gags me and hits my stomach, and I throw up, and I throw up, and I throw up till the green bile starts coming up, and I throw up some more. Sweat starts rolling down me, and it takes about 10 minutes, and it settles down a little bit, and I look at that bottle again, and I take another pull on that bottle. And the same thing happens over again. And after about fourth time, it stays down. And that was the magic for me, once it stayed down. Now, when my sis says, yeah, but why'd you have to take the drink? How could I possibly explain why I had to take that drink? But talking to a bunch of alcoholics, they know why I took that drink. They know exactly why I had to take that drink. You know, there was a lot of magic in alcohol for me for many, many years until I hit the chronic stages of alcoholism. I was 40 years old when I hit that stage. You know, and then I found the magic in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the role got reversed, and I found sobriety. I was raised in a little town in northern Minnesota, and I came from immigrant parents, and when I was born, my dad was overjoyed. He thought, God, he had a son, had two daughters, and all of a sudden he had a son, and here's a kid who's going to be a doctor or an engineer. He's going to be something great. If my dad knew it was coming down the pike, he would have threw the baby away with the bathwater. I'll guarantee you. I was the greatest disappointment to my dad and mom. And one of my great regrets is they never saw me sober. They both passed away the year I sobered up. And they never saw the mess. All they ever saw was this 40-year-old drunk. And I was in chronic alcoholism at that stage. You know, and they were ashamed of me, and they didn't want allow me in their homes, and my sisters or my folks wouldn't allow me home, and nobody wanted nothing to do with me. I know I was a bartender, and I no longer could hold a job, and when you can't hold a bartender's job, you're in bad trouble. You know, but I worked for the same guy here around town for 9 years, and once I crossed that line, I couldn't work for anybody. They'd hire me, and within 3 or 4 days, I'd get in a fight, or I'd jump over the bar and get in a fight with a customer, or I'd fall down behind the bar, and I was just a mess. You know, when I left here, and And I attended about 4 or 5 bars there in town. I went to Alaska and attended 4 or 5 bars there in 6 or 7 months and almost died, and went to Minnesota where I was born and raised and attended bar there for 6 or 7 more bars until finally my sis took me and stuck me in a detox center. And through that detox center, I found this Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I went to a detox center 4 different times. When I went there the first time, I thought I met a wonderful man there. His name is Warren McGinley, and Warren just celebrated 50 years of sobriety, and I was just back in Minneapolis to help him celebrate that. And Warren sat down with me and told me his story. He didn't preach to me, he just told me his story, and I just thought he was the neatest guy in the world, you know. And after I was getting ready to go home, my sister brought my car down, and Warren says, "What are you going to do now, Len?" I said, "Well, I'm going to go up to northern Minnesota. I'm going to talk Dad into the house, and I'm not going to drink anymore." And Warren said, "Okay." And my sis said, "Are you crazy? He's never been able to do that in all his life. Why do you think he's going to do it now?" Warren just smiled, and kind Warren, and he says, "Well, I didn't say that I thought he would stay sober. But that's what he wants to do, and who am I to say different?" So Warren became my friend, and you know, and about 3 months later, my dad passed away, and Mom was in a rest home, and I had stayed sober through all that, and some girls I met in the bar, and they said, "Meet us at the airport in Hibbing, Minnesota." And so I go out there, and the girls don't show up, and I drink 3 or 4 Cokes, and it's a warm summer night, and I says, beer tastes pretty good, you know, and I drink a beer, and drink 2, 3 beers and 4 beers, and nothing happens. And next morning I get up and I don't have a hangover, and I always have a hangover, and I says, people don't know what the hell they're talking about. What do you mean alcoholic? Make a long story short, within 2 weeks I'm back hallucinating, driving down to St. Paul, Minnesota to see Warren and get back in that detox center. And I did that 4 different times. So Warren finally says one day, he says, "Lenny, you can't keep going on like this the rest of your life and coming back to this place. Why don't you go in a treatment center?" So he got me into Moose Lake, Minnesota. And I was ready to leave the detox center. I was going up to Moose Lake, and my sis came again, and she brought the car, and I said, "Dottie, I need $20. My sis was my ace in the hole. I said, "Dottie, I need $20. She said, "What do you need $20 for?" I said, "I'm going to a treatment center for 30 days. She said, "Well, you don't need any money." I said, "Well, of course you do." I said, "I might need cigarettes." And she said, "I bought you a couple of cartons. They're sitting on a seat to your car." I said, "Well, I need gas for the car." And she says, "Your car is full of gas, and you can't go anyplace when you're at treatment center." I said, "Well, you know how it is, Dottie." And Dottie gave me that $20, and you know what happened. The minute I was out of her sight, I pulled in a little grocery store and got me another bottle of wine and got drunk all over again until the $20 was gone. And then I checked into Moose Lake, Minnesota. Going to Moose Lake, let me tell you about Moose Lake, Minnesota. That's what, like, Damnish is here. It's the nut house. But part of it became an alcohol treatment center. But as I was growing up as a little kid, my mother and all her cronies were always saying about their kids, "You're driving me to Moose Lake." So all of a sudden, this high roller from Portland's back in town, and he's going to the nut house, is what I thought. But I went there and I spent 30 days there, and I don't know what they said. All I know is they told me that for a guy like me to stay sober for any length of time, I better find a program like Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did. And I started coming here, and I moved back to Portland shortly after that. By this time, my wife had divorced me. She didn't want nothing to do with me. And we were divorced for a couple of years. And I want to tell you now that Pat and I have been together for 44 years, minus those 2 years. So being sober for 33 years and being married for 44 years to the same woman is pretty rare in this day and age. So Pat and I, after about 2 years, I kept telling Pat, "Let's get back together." And Pat said, "Are you kidding? You goddamn drunk." I said, "Yeah, Pat, I don't drink anymore." She says, "I've heard that before." I said, "Yeah, but this time it's different." And she says, "You know, I heard that before too." I says, "Yeah, but it's really different." And she says, "I've heard that before." Well, anyway, to make a long story short, Pat and I got back together after a couple of years. And after about a year, you know, a couple of the gals kept telling Pat to come to Al-Anon, and she wouldn't go to Al-Anon. And old Virginia, coming from Virginia, God bless her, she'd come on to knock on the door every Wednesday night and try to drag Pat. And finally she started going, "Pat, started going to Al-Anon meetings and Patson Al-Anon for 30 years now. See, and so we became a AA family, you know, and we get along great. That's the nicest part of it, you know. And Pat and I, Pat's probably my best friend now. We just get along great, you know. And oh, I mean, we have our quibbles, you know, and sometimes she won't shut up, but that's just the way it is, you know. But for most of it, we're buddies, and she's not, like I say, she's not here, but she's, I've heard you talk before. She's, I know all your jokes, but she's a dear girl, and like I say, we're getting older together, and it's kind of neat. You know, if you're new at Alcoholics Anonymous, there's magic here in this room, and there's magic here in this program. And believe that. There really is. I know how it is when you first come around. Just because I've been sober for 33 years doesn't mean I don't remember for one second how it was the day I arrived and how it was for the first year. I started going to that Hollywood meeting on 21st and Schuyler on Tuesday nights, and I went to a meeting someplace every single night, and I can remember how painful it was because I wasn't with Pat and I was lonely and I didn't know what to do with myself. But I kept going to meetings because people were nice and you treated me nicely, and I had to have to do something, and my old boss gave me a job in concrete construction and making $3 an hour, and I'd work my butt off all day long and get off work and I'd drink a couple of Cokes, and I wanted to drink so goddamn bad I just can't tell you how bad I wanted to drink. And I haven't forgotten that, you know. And sometimes, because I've been around a long time and I see this guy, he needs a drink. Hell, that's what alcoholics do. They go back and get a drink, you know. And people are amazed. You know, they say, why did he go get drunk? Hell, he's an alcoholic. That's why he went and got a drink. You know, our normal state is drunk. It was mine anyway. So just keep coming back. And you know, my friend Bob Masterson, he's over in a rest home. He started Obies with me, but Bob's got 39 years sobriety. And he's got Parkinson's disease real bad, and he's over in Camas, Washington. And I go over to see him once in a while, and he can't talk very good, and I can't hear very good, and we have a hell of a time. But but we've been close for a lot of years. But I've quoted this from Bob, and Bob used to always say it, and he came from Denver, and he had 6 years of sobriety when I came here. And he always used to say, hey, keep coming back to this program. Do what this program says, and you'll wake up one morning, and you'll feel different about yourself. And when that happens, it's not necessary to take a drink anymore. And that's happened to me, and it's happened to countless others. You know, if you just keep coming back, you will wake up different, and you'll feel different about yourself. And what a neat feeling. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the people in it. I don't hate anybody. So everybody says, Lenny, you just can't love everybody. It's important. I say, who said that? You can. Some people, I don't like what they do. But I actually love people, and I love everybody. You know, I'm a hugger, and I just love people. You know, I can't hate. You know, I hate all over. I'm 6'2" and 230 pounds, and when I get to hating, all that size just comes out in me, and I just get vile. And my mouth is the biggest, my worst enemy. When I was drinking, Pat says, I wish the hell you just beat me up. Instead of that dirty mouth of yours. She says, you just run off at the mouth and you never shut up. And once I get mad, I just don't shut up. I'll overpower you. I'll just talk and talk and talk and cuss and then that feeling gets inside of me and I don't like that feeling. So I find it so much easier to love you people and to be kind. And I don't always practice what I preach. I still blow once in a while, but not very often. You know, and I can apologize. And that's the nice part of being around this program. This program teaches you so much. If you just hang around, that's the secret. You got to hang around. You got to go to meetings. I say meetings are the most important thing for an alcoholic. And the reason is, if you don't go to meetings, you're back out there with your cronies, and you know what you're doing. Old Johnny Harris, the first time I heard, he said, keep doing what you're doing and keep getting what you're getting. And he said, that's so important, I'm going to repeat it. Keep doing what you're doing, keep getting what you're getting. And that means the good stuff and the bad stuff. I've had a lot of ups and downs in this program. I've had good times and I've had bad times. I've had some terrible things happen to me and I've had a lot of good things happen to me. I try to forget the bad things, one of the worst things, and I can't forget it. On Christmas Eve of 1986, my son, Lenny, was 18 years old. On Christmas Eve morning, he decided he didn't want to be around us anymore, and he committed suicide. I can never forget that. You know, every day something comes up. You know, and to this day it makes me cry when I talk about it. That's how painful that was. You know, and nothing I could, nothing, you know, many people say, what would you do differently? And hell, I don't know what the hell I'd do different. I do the best, I did the best I knew how. You know, and I struggled through that for a long, long time. If it wasn't for the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have never made it. You know, and they all embraced me, and Pat and I, and just walked us through it for a lot of years. And I've had a lot of other friends, that same thing happened to them, and I helped walk them through it. You know, and I'll never forget Lenny. He was the apple of my eye. He was like I was to my dad. You know, he was going to be something. Unfortunately, some drugs and whatever else he took made him do that. You know, and about 3 months after, his best friend copycatted that suicide. And he was only 18 years old. You know, and 30 days later, my best friend Ernie Aldridge, with 35 years sobriety, died from cirrhosis of the liver. And but that's my story and some of the bad things. Some of the good things, I've had a lot of good things happen to me. You know, the most is back with my wife and living this long as I have lived. You know, but I was fortunate enough to start a business. It grew pretty big. In fact, I'm an auctioneer, and it became one of the largest auction companies in the Northwest. People think I'm a millionaire, but I didn't watch my money. I was one hell of an entrepreneur and one terrible businessman. But we live and we learn. I just did an auction down in Willits, California. I don't talk about drugs because I don't know anything about drugs. I mean, I never was a pothead. I never smoked. I smoked pot twice. All that ever made me want to do is contemplate my belly button and I wonder what alcohol did for me. It speeded me up. You know, that's my part of the other drugs. I took a little Dexedrine, and now I did that just to make me drink a little longer. So I can't tell you too much about drugs, but I know a lot about alcohol. You know, the biggest emphasis, if I can just reach one person in this room and show them that they don't have to drink and they can live a successful life. You know, I can show you people in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous that stories are unbelievable. Unbelievable what they've accomplished in their life through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is an inside job. All answers lie within. I'm a firm believer of that. I'm a firm believer that the purpose of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is to bring us closer to our Creator. And once we become there, we can find out that through this power, we can do just about anything in life. Does that take a lot of work? You bet. Do I always want to do that? Nope. No, a lot of times I don't want to do that. It's work. You know, but I found once I get in tune with my Creator, that things in my life get a little better. You know, and I don't like to get preachy, because the preachy people just drive me goofy. And I'm sure if you're newer, my preaching will drive you. I got a sister that's a born-again Christian. Nothing wrong with born-again Christians. And there's probably some of them in this room. But Dorothy likes to preach. And she's always saying, Len, you got to get with Jesus Christ, and you got to do this, and you got to do that, and you got to do this. And when she does, the switch just goes off. I mean, and I don't do that intentionally. It just a switch goes off. I can't handle it. She just, and she's talking in my head someplace else. You know, and they think they can handle us people, you know, and they got the answer for us. They ain't got no answer. The answer for me is sit on that stump with that drunk, and he'll tell me what, like, Bob and Bill got together, and they told each other a story. You know, then I got that way with Dorothy. I start preaching to her about Al-Anon, and, you know, I can see that blank look on her face. You know, so preaching doesn't get it. And once in a while, I get a little preachy. Once in a while, I get to talking about God or this power or whatever you want to call it. Call it Buddha. Call it whatever you want to call it. But if you're newer, when I first came around, those people get to talking about that, that switch would turn. I don't want to listen to it. You know? But that's what the answer is. That's what this program's all about. It's spiritual, and not a, just part of it's not spiritual, it's all spiritual. And once you find the answer, you know, I spend a lot of time in meditation. I used to meditate a lot. I used to always spend a half an hour in the morning, half an hour at night meditating. My life got so good, I quit meditating. You know, and didn't do it for a long time. Now I'm back meditating, and I find out it brings peace and serenity to me and quiet, and I love the silence, and it takes a lot of work. You know, and I've become a little better listener, not as good as I should be, but I've become a little listener. Listening is an art. You know, I'd rather be talking. And my wife says I talk too much. You know, I've told this joke probably a million times. I'm not even sure it's a joke. It might be a true story, Carl. You probably, Carl's an expert at jokes. He can probably tell me it's a true story. You know, when Neil Armstrong, and I think I told him this room before one time, when Neil Armstrong came back out of space and he was breaking into the atmosphere, he said, yeah, that's the guy that says, you know, one big step for man and one big step for mankind. When he's back in, coming back into space, he says, good luck, Mr. Gorsky. You know, and boy, NASA donors going through the book, who the hell is Mr. Gorsky? You know, nobody knew who Mr. Gorsky was, and when he got on the ground, they asked him, and he just smiled and wouldn't tell him. And it went on for years, and every once in a while, a reporter would say, you know, when you came back into space, who's Mr. Gorsky? And he just kind of smiled, wouldn't tell anybody. 25 years went by, and he was down in Florida giving a big seminar, and some pup reporter asked him, you know, many years ago when you came back into space, you said, good luck, Mr. Gorsky. Who's Mr. Gorsky? Well, he said, I can tell you the story now, because Mr. and Mrs. Gorsky are dead, have passed away. He said, when I was a little boy, 8 years old, I lived next door to Mr. Gorsky. And we were playing baseball. And I was playing out in center field, and the kid hit a home run, and the ball flew over my head and went over and landed right under Mr. Gorsky's window. And just as I was picking up the ball, I heard Mrs. Gorsky tell Mr. Gorsky, sex, you want sex? You'll get sex when that kid next door lands on the moon. That always brings a laugh. Makes it funny. I just love those stories that go along in the punchline. This lady used to bring her boyfriend over when her husband went off to work, and she had a little boy about 5 years old, and she'd lock him in a closet. And one day the husband came home early, and she threw her boyfriend in the closet with this little boy. And the guy says, the little boy says, boy, it's dark in here. And the guy says, yeah, it sure is dark. And the little boy says, I got a flashlight. And the guy says, can I see the flashlight? And he says, yeah, $10. You know, so the guy peeled out $10, give it to this little boy. And the little kid thought, hell, that works so good. He says, hey, I got a pocket knife. And the guy says, I don't need a pocket knife. He said, I'm going to sell it to you. 50 cents. He says, I don't need a pocket knife. He says, you don't buy my pocket knife, I'll scream. So he had no choice, so he gave him 50 cents for the pocket knife. That night he's home and talking to his dad, and he says, hey, Dad, he says, I really made a score today. I sold my flashlight for $10, and I sold my pocket knife for 50 cents. And his dad says, son, you cheated that man. That flashlight wasn't worth a dollar, and you sold it to him for 10 cents, and the knife was a rusty old knife, and you shouldn't have got anything for it. He says, for punishment, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. He says, I'm going to send you down to the priest, and you're going to go to confession, and you're going to tell that priest what you did and how you gypped this guy. And whatever the priest says your punishment's going to be, that's going to be your punishment. He goes down there, and they get in the confession booth, and the little boy says, God, is dark in here. And the priest says, you're not going to start that crap again, are you? Anyway, that's my jokes for the night. My wife would be proud of me. Well, like I say, if you're newer, you know, laughter is good for the soul. I just love people when they laugh. You know, no matter how bad you feel inside, if you can hear something and makes you laugh, it just kind of relieves that tension, and you find out life is a little easier, and the things aren't that bad. You know, when you start thinking things are really, just think, when you think they're really bad, if you're having a crappy day today and things are really tough, 6 months from now or a year from now, think about today. Hell, you won't even remember it. And that's about 99% of what happens to us. But if you try to stay in a positive mood, and that's not always easy, if you keep coming back to these meetings, I'll tell you that the secret's here, the magic's here. I can't emphasize that enough for a newer person. There is magic here. You don't have to drink. It's not easy to drink. People think that it's easy for us people to drink. That's the hardest thing I ever did in my life was to drink. You know, I was always going, trying to find an attorney or trying to pay fines or trying to beat the cops or trying to do something, and I had a full-time job, you know. Now all I got to do is go to meetings and tell jokes. You know? It's a trip, you know. And I want you to keep coming back. You know, if you're new, I really want you to keep coming back. Nothing does me better to watch them. I was thinking about a couple of girls that, I'm a member of the Lunch Bunch out in Gresham. We meet every noon at 12 o'clock, from 12 to 1. There's very few days goes by that I'm not at the Lunch Bunch. There's a couple of girls that have been here lately. They're pretty girls. But when they walked in, their face was so tight, it looked like they were carrying the world on their shoulders. And then I watch them as weeks and months go by, their face starts softening up, they start laughing, their beauty starts coming out, and you wonder, geez, what happened to that girl that was here 2-3 months ago when they came in? And that's what happens in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Things change. Is this going to be, like I see, is this going to be a panacea? You think you're going to be happy all the time? No, it's not a chance. But a lot happier than you were when you were getting drunk. And your life will change. And you can change it to any, I know without a shadow of a doubt, you can change it to any degree you want to change. Turn within. The answers lie within you. You know, and people say, what do you mean by that? Just, you'll know when you'll know. You'll know when you know. All answers lie within you. All answers lie within this power. You know, and I happen to call it God. It took me a long time to call it God, but I happen to call it God. I know there's a power out there. I'm not too smart a guy myself, you know, and as far as business goes, I didn't have much to do with that. I'm not very smart. Things just come to me, and I just, out of the clear blue sky, things will pop into my life. Because I'm an auctioneer, people think I'm a super salesman. You know, that was the hardest thing, because when I was growing up and through my younger years, everybody wanted me to be a salesman. They said, Lenny, you're a good-looking guy, and you have a personality, and they didn't know the fear was inside of me. I was so scared of people, and I covered it up, but I was so scared of it, people, and I found out that drinks, and that's one of the reasons I drank. And I'll never forget, my sister got me a job selling insurance one time. I was petrified. And we were selling to some, I forget the policy, to the farmers in southern Minnesota. And I was petrified to go talk to them. I can't tell you why. I mean, they couldn't bite me or nothing, but people would talk to me, and I couldn't tell anybody I was afraid. So one day I made up my mind, I'm going to find the nicest farm with the nicest big fence around it, and I'm going to sell that guy a policy. And I pull up in front of that big gate of his, and oh God, I couldn't catch my breath. But I had a bottle in the car. So I says, I'll take a drink, and then I'll feel better, and I'll be able to talk to the guy. So then I took a drink, and then I took a drink, and I took a drink, and then I'm all drunk, and I said, he ain't going to buy no insurance anyway. So then I became an auctioneer, and I says, why is it so easy for me to auction, and it's so hard for me on a one-on-one? When you auction, you're up there in front, you're like on a microphone. Nobody can give you any, they can't tell you anything, you know, just, hey, you're the boss. And I loved auctioneering, and I became pretty good at it. Now I was telling to Jack before the meeting, God, if I never auctioned again, the rest of my life wouldn't bother me a bit. In fact, I'd be happy. You know, I just kind of burnt myself out. But I just keep plugging along. And I'm really fortunate I've been able to come and talk to you people. And I hope somebody heard something. That keep them sober for one more day. That's all you got to do, stay sober for one more day. And then when tomorrow comes, stay sober for one more day. And if you keep doing that, all of a sudden you wake up one morning and you have 33 years of sobriety. And you know something? That's kind of neat. I love each and every one of you. Keep coming back. Thanks.